White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a overcast, cool day here in the heartland. It's September the 12th, 2014, Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the bunker. Thank you all you she-wolves out there working hard for the race. That's right. And we're at P.O. Box 401, as usual. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Our big website is resist.com. And that's the way you get to us. And a lot of you people have got your September dues or donations in for the radio show, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Okay, let's get to the news. There's got to be some good news somewhere. And there's got to be some bad news for our opposition. Bad news for Obama. He's sinking in the quicksand. They got him on the run. They want him to go over there and bomb the boys. Yeah. And all of a sudden the Republicans say, well, yeah, but he didn't do it quick enough. Didn't do it soon enough. Well, I get these messages from the Oh My God squad all the time. I just got one today, obviously, from a right-winger, or at least partly right-winger, conservative type, conservative, I guess. He says, this will have an effect on people. I bet they will pay attention when and if this occurs. I look for this to happen soon, from how things are being handled every day in this country. Business will come to a standstill, and the country will be as we have never seen it. The Depression was a picnic to what's coming. See, this guy, he knows all that stuff, man. He's on the inside there. Yeah. If I remember correctly, there are just 7 main junctions of our electrical grid. I have been on several of them in my life. Mm-hmm. It won't take much to cut those off totally. Gee, surprise, surprise. When this happens, guess what stops? How many bridges across the Mississippi? When they go and the railroad goes, all that crap will be in the Mississippi River. So there won't be any boat transportation up and down the river. Well, I've never taken a boat up and down the river, so I don't give a shit. Folks, we all are asleep. The fox is in the hen house with his buddies. My personal feeling is in the month of January, February, would really hurt this country to blow the pipeline and the electric. I have worried about this now for many years. I've gone bald thinking about it. No, I pray now one knows the key factors in this country. Please think about this. Oh, I'm thinking about it. Because I love this country. Well, I love a woman. I love the land I'm sitting on, I guess, even though it's an inanimate object. And I have raised my right hand to defend it with my life. I have read today in Michigan where a dad could not visit his daughter in his military uniform because he would offend the Muslims at school. I didn't read that. Well, if he has any balls, he wears his military uniform anyhow. I am offended because they are taking out our freedom every day. Well, you're living in a big concentration camp already, fool. We haven't known true freedom, freedom from war and all that stuff, for a long, long time. We'd better take a lesson from Japan about these folks. From Japan? This guy's supposed to be in the Marine Corps or something. Well, I don't know. The Japanese haven't done too well lately, and they got Fukushima. If they get another 8 or 9 point earthquake over there, Japan is history. So, this is labeled urgent terrorist threat. Well, most of this stuff on here, I wouldn't be unhappy if it happened, because that would bring the real men with real testicles out and get the other kind out of the way. You know what these conservatives cry and worry and fret and lose their hair over? I look forward to. And if you're the lone wolf, you know what I'm talking about. Because nothing can happen unless this whole thing starts unraveling fast. And I'm waiting for it. Yeah, I got a coal oil lamp. I've got ways of heating. I got plenty of water. I can walk to town. I'm not worried about this stuff. I might have to fire up my old crystal radio set from the old days, but other than that, it'll be mono, not stereo. So anyhow, there's a typical, oh my God, it's all coming apart. Well, it needs to come apart. It should come apart. It was never meant to last under these conditions. So what you cry and moan about, I look forward to. As far as electrical grid, anybody with a log chain can put half of a state out of commission. If they throw that log chain over those high-tension wires, ooh, things start sparking and shutting down fast, like they did up there in Washington State. Remember, about a year ago, they blew a power station, everything, and power went down all over the place. They never did find out who did that. But I thought we had Homeland Security. Yeah, right. Well, here's something I picked up off the web. You might find it sort of funny. Yeah, right. Superman fights the Klan.
Hey, this is cantaloupe. You want to put that in your mouth?
Uh-huh. Or... why is it in my mouth?
That was cantaloupe.
I like cantaloupe.
Okay.
I don't know what pineapple. This has got you to like do pineapple? With anything.
I like pineapple.
What the hell is this?
For 10 episodes of the Superman radio show, Superman fought the KKK.
Up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. No, it's Superman. Superman battling valiantly against the Klan of the Fiery Cross. Jimmy Olsen protected by the power of Superman and his mighty might. I don't fucking know. Careful, Jimmy. Don't touch that fiery cross. Shucks, Mr. Kent. Whatever you say.
There was no YouTube. There was no podcast. Everybody listened to the radio. As this was happening, Stetson Kennedy would call them and say, here are the new passwords that the KKK are using this week. The code word was Anglo. The password was American. The next week on the Superman show, Superman would show up and say, Anglo. And one of the bad guys would respond with, American. The kids of the Klansmen were playing Superman against the KKK. Following the broadcast of the Superman episodes, one of the heads of the Klavern said to the leader, sir, I cannot in good conscience continue as a member of this Klavern when my own children are poking fun at the Klan of the Fiery Cross.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Well, anyhow, that was a little funny that came down the pike. Well, did you know Thomas the Train was a racist? Well, he is. It says here, the TV show Thomas and Friends is racist, wrote Tracy Van Syke for The Guardian newspaper in July, because good engines puff white smoke and bad engines puff black smoke. She is so relieved her son doesn't have a manic train fascination like so many other children, because although the show seems to impart good moral lessons about hard work and friendship, it's in reality concealing some pretty twisted messages, unquote. It's racist, classist, sexist, and anti-environmentalist. The smoke is just one example. I like to think there was a good environmental message in there, she writes. But when good engines pump out white smoke and bad engines pump out black smoke, it's not hard to make the leap into the race territory, unquote. Another person who has no trouble leaping into the race territory is author and activist Leonard Zeskin. Good old Leonard, the Jew. Who said at the National White Privilege Conference that the entire Tea Party is marked by contagious racism? Gee, I only wish it was. Quote, there has been a longitudinal study that finds the longer you're in the Tea Party, the more racist you become, unquote, he declared, and said the movement is like another white nationalist group. It is racist, he asked, and then answered himself, yes. The Tea Party rallying cry, take back our country, is racist, Eugene Robinson wrote in a Washington Post op-ed in May. Quote, in general, I try to focus on what person does and says rather than speculate on what he and she is. How can I really know what's in another person's heart, he asks, before implying that anyone holding a take back our country sign is racist, since they started using the phrase after a black man became president. A Connecticut resident complained that a version of the musical Thoroughly Modern Millie performed at a local high school was racist because of his portrayal of Asians. Quote, we would never do anything anti-Jewish or anti-African-American, she wrote on her blog Pragmatic Mom. Blackface is unthinkable, but yellowface, it's utterly fine. A community meeting was called, and the theater director apologized profusely. Quote, I'm sorry. I am so, so sorry you are feeling anger. The anger that you're feeling, said director Adam Brown. We blew it. I'm sorry, unquote. Harvard professor Carol Oja told the Boston Globe, who covered the story, many Broadway classics contain troubling racial stereotypes. Quote, being sensitive is really important, Oja said. In a strange twist, a federal judge in California implied that teacher tenure laws are racist because they allow bad teachers to stick around and deprive students of a good education, and a disproportionate number of those students affected are minorities, reported the New York Times. Quote, the evidence is compelling, Judge Rolf M. True wrote in the ruling, quote, indeed, it shocks conscience. True said his ruling ties into the Brown v. Board of Education because good teachers are a part of ensuring an equality of educational experience. The Portland African American Leadership Forum has made it very clear that the presence of Trader Joe's in the northeast Portland is unacceptable because it would attract too many white people, reported the Associated Press. Trader Joe's would increase the desirability for non-oppressed populations, the forum wrote in a letter to Portland after it got wind of plans for a new Trader Joe's in the area. And the mayor actually signed a letter saying that the Portland Development Commission, which had offered Trader Joe's a good deal on the property, was contributing to the, quote, destructive impact of gentrification and displacement on the African-American community, unquote. Trader Joe's did not protest and took his business elsewhere. Well, you think these are jokes? No, this is really going on. This is in reality how far they've pushed white people to the wall, and the white people just take it. I'm amused by it because whites that won't fight back they deserve what they get. I have no sympathy at all for them. Screw them. We don't want Trader Joe's. There are too many white people here. And make sure you don't let your kid watch any of these cartoons about Thomas the Train, especially when it blows white smoke out its stack. Well, let's check in to San Francisco. a week into its run in the Castro district of San Francisco, Bandidos, the new Mexican restaurant from High Tops owners Jesse Woodward and Dana Gleam, is changing its name. It'll now be known as Heco, for the Spanish word to make. The name has been changed in response to allegations from San Francisco's mestizos community that the term Bandidos is racist and offensive. Good. I like racist and offensive terms. Fans that were flamed when consulting chef Jamie Lauren commented that, quote, "I hate to call Bandidos cuisine, white people, Mexican food, but it is." In an interview, older Latino activists fought so that name wouldn't be used, says writer-actor Marga Gomez, a Mexican-American and Castro resident who led the call for the name change. "You can't call that restaurant Bandidos, you racist bastard." "Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'll change the name right now," instead of saying, "Fuck you, greaser." It was never the most popular ethnic slur, but I'm familiar with that term being used as a slur from those old movies in the 30s and 40s, where all the villains were Mexican. Well, if they were bandits, they were bandidos, stupid. Even some younger Latinos might think this is stupid, but it's because they never had to live with the older Latino activists fought so that the name wouldn't be used. Well, I like that name. I'm going to paint it on my fence outside my house. In a statement on Facebook, Woodward and Gleam, the owners, say they chose the moniker Heco, which also belongs to a now-closed sushi and tequila spot in the Fidei, because our menu is inspired by Mexican cuisine, but has a San Francisco twist to it. We believe that this is an appropriate name, which means we're not just one specific style. We are made everywhere. In addition, they apologize for any offense, saying, "We have been saddened that unknowingly the name of the restaurant we recently opened has offended the greasers." Oh, God, the greasers, they're offended. "This was never our intention, and we feel horrible about it. So we have decided to change the name. More chicken shit whites." Yep. In an interview prior to the announcement of the name change, Gomez said she didn't feel the slight was intentional. Quote, "I don't think they meant to offend. They didn't know. They're just stupid white people. If they changed the name, I think it's a teachable moment," unquote. Her criticism lay only with the name, not the restaurant's bill of fare prices. Quote, "People complain that they're charging $12 for two tacos. I don't care about that, because cheap Mexicans won't go there anyhow. It's a high-end foodie restaurant. They're using better ingredients. You don't want to put Mexican food in a box where it always has been cheap. I think the menu looks great, and if they change the name, I'll be glad to eat there. I'll forgive the white people." Bandidos' external signage has already been removed, and the new moniker should be going up soon. Wow. Bye-bye, Bandidos. There never were any Mexican bandits. Forget that. Never happened. Forget it. You know, a lot of people who talk about race are always looking for bad news. I'm looking for good news. And I'm going to show you where bad news, according to the rank and file, are good news to us. Let's go over to St. Louis, where they want to know how to combat racism. Well, it's a waste of time to try and combat racism. Mother Nature gave us racism. "Once again, we in this region of St. Louis are faced with racism and alleged racist actions to be determined by the courts in the month ahead. Sadly, this is not new. We have faced it since Missouri permitted slavery and African Americans were not allowed to be educated." Well, that's sort of an oxymoron. In fact, in 1847, the Missouri General Assembly made it illegal to try and educate African Americans, as reported in my book, Unending Struggle, The Long Road to Equal Education in St. Louis. Well, there can't be equal education. There's no way between peoples that are unequal. There has been a deep record in our area of inequality, of course, and there always will be, one way or another, in race relations, and there has been deep institutional inequality for several hundred years, and it will remain. It won't change. It may change the faces, but if all the white people were gone, then all the lighter Negroes would be racist against the black Negroes. Missouri history in this arena is terrible, meaning it was pro-white. Thus, when Michael Brown was shot and killed in Ferguson, these deep-rooted feelings surfaced. No, your animalistic nature surfaced. The racial tensions and concurrent incidents that happened for so many days and weeks could have been anticipated. Of course. Obviously. The big question is, what will this community do to get at this long-time systemic ill, unquote? Well, there's nothing you're going to be able to do because it's biological, baby. It's genetic. While we have made many strides in our schools and housing and some in hiring and businesses, we have a long way to go. You notice how they always have, we have a long way to go. In other words, you have to give up more of your race, give up more of territory as the white race, and like that. As long as you're giving up to these people, they're going to say, oh, we're doing okay, but we got a long way to go, motherfucker. In St. Louis had a very successful inter-district transfer program for many years in the late 1980s. In other words, it allowed more than 50,000 Nigger Americans the opportunity to receive a better education. Yeah, they moved them into white schools and screwed up the whole educational system for whites, dragging a whole lot of white people, young people, down into a nigger quagmire to where they've been niggerified. Many in-service programs for suburban teachers have been held to help them because more successful in working with Negro American children. This community worked on housing equity. There you go with that stupid thing, equity, equality. Never was, never will be. With the Freedom of Residence program, which was moderately successful, and it worked well, being an anti-white program, and existing programs work with racial profiling for police officers. But here we go again. So now what? Is racism so ingrained in us that nothing will help? Of course it is. Nothing's going to help. In fact, from your point of view, it's going to get worse. This is good news, man. My news is good. Well, he says, I cannot accept that belief. Well, I don't care if you accept it or not, Mr. Negro man. It's a fact of life. We must again work on many of these issues through the workshops, additional training for the police and teachers, and communities at large. Well, I can guarantee you the police are not going to get less violent. They're going to get more violent. We cannot allow this status quo, and we do not want to be known across the country as a racist city. Not St. Louis, even though we have East St. Louis and we have St. Louis. And East St. Louis is almost all Negro. We cannot accept what has happened, and we cannot give up. We all know that change comes about slowly, but these attitudes cannot continue. I do believe that these students who were part of the inter-district transfer program, both the transfer students and the suburban students in the schools where they got to know one another. Yeah, yeah, come here, little white girl. I'm Sambo, and I want to, you know, do what I do. Have a different perspective and will in time become part both of the city and county workplaces where they can help change attitudes. Well, of course, You knew it, and I knew it, way, way back in the 50s. Once they started integrating the schools, it's going to be a slow decline of the white race, or maybe a fast decline of the white race. They knew exactly what they were doing, whether they were white renegades or Jews or whoever. First, we have to mix them up in the schools. Yeah. And then encourage them to date each other and all that kind of shit. In the meantime, communities must work to re-educate or brainwash police departments, city workers, and others whom are in integrated settings. This is the only way we can begin to make a difference. In other words, make it more pro-non-white. And hope that we have no more Fergusons. Believe me, you're going to have plenty of Fergusons. Well, skipping over to Northern Ireland, Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness, a white guy, has launched an extraordinary attack on unionist politicians, claiming they routinely excuse and defend racism, sectarianism, and homophobia. Right on, unionists. Cool. Well, how about this? A study by Rutgers University, Newark, claims that minorities are fat because racial microaggressions cause them to eat fast food and avoid exercise. Quote, when you are exposed to negative stereotypes like nigga, you may gravitate more towards unhealthy foods as opposed to healthy foods, unquote, said Louis Imaspic-Rivera, the experimental social psychologist who conducted the study. Quote, you may have a less positive attitude towards watching your carbs or cutting back on your fast food and toward working out and exercising, he explained. That's the reason. It's racism. I keep telling you it's racism. That's good. I support you there, Mr. Rivera. Rivera said mestizos who believed negative stereotypes about themselves were three times more likely to get fat or overly obese, evidence that obesity comes from believing in stereotypes. Either that or the demons. We know it can't be caused by mere overeating in a true leftist fashion. We must get to the root of the cause, which in true leftist fashion is racism, baby. It's all racism. Eating less is futile. The only way to fix this problem, like all problems, is to fight racism for a better, slimmer, skinnier world. Louis Rivera, who is not fat because he doesn't believe in stereotypes, is an assistant professor of psychology at Rutgers. Oh, wow. Okay, his research focuses on the implicit social cognitive processes that underlie the expression of stereotyping and prejudice and how such processes affect stigmatized individuals' self-conception of themselves and health, just in case you had any reason to take the field seriously. Don't, but you'll be hearing lots more from Lewis, who has figured out how not only troll with a social scientist, and a valuable, invaluable skill in his field, but how to get noticed. Expect a book from him any day now. Quote, I'm fat, it's your fault. Unquote. Well, here was a comment on that. How does he explain obesity and fatness in whites, then? Racist sentiments that compel them to overindulge as celebration of their inherent supremacy over all other peoples. The fact that these minority groups, non-white, can get so portly fat seems to trump the idea that they are trapped in grinding poverty. Nobody's trapped in grinding poverty. One does not take on a cetacean-like appearance if you've no money for food. Well, this obesity of whites, these are obviously not whites, they're albino niggers. And that's why you see so many white so-called people around. They're really albino niggers. So that answers that question. Here's another comment. several years ago, I used to jog most mornings by the East River in New York City. My run took me through a housing project, with waterfront property no less. If you want to find peace and quiet on weekday mornings, hang out by any city housing project. You can hear a pin drop. That's because nobody is leaving or entering the buildings. Everyone still is fast asleep because most don't have jobs on the waterfront and on the dole. Ah, yeah. And again, people cannot and will not thrive under Democrat leadership. The old party crap. Where I live, a large high-rise housing project was torn down in the major metropolitan of the state. The residents were spread out through the state, Negroes. Some ended up in virtually all white towns and cities. One in particular had a very little crime. Blacks were responsible for two-thirds of the murders in a city that is 98% white. I remember driving through a neighborhood in the city, seeing a young 20-ish black, overweight woman walking. Of course, my hackles went up. I had heard about the transferring of welfare cases, but I calmed down when I realized all she was doing was walking to get healthier and stay healthy. She was not a threat. She was doing something she could not safely do in a minority-controlled city. Yeah, but when she gets healthy and all that kind of stuff, she might turn to a life of crime and murder more white people. If she's too fat to chase white people, she probably won't catch any. Anyhow, that's a lot of good news for today. I mean, that's just a little of it. If you go on these Google alerts and put in racism, this kind of stuff goes on for pages, and white people talking back and fighting back too. So I don't see what you're so upset about and downtrodden.
Brignone Ponce was driving two undocumented passengers on a highway north of San Diego.
And they discovered that the passengers had no papers authorizing them to be in the United States. The respondent and the passengers were then arrested.
Brignone Ponce was a U.S. citizen, but he was charged with human smuggling. He fought the case, arguing the agent shouldn't have stopped him in the first place, since the agent admitted the only reason he pulled over the car was because the people inside looked Mexican.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
John Cleary was the federal public defender who represented Brignone Ponce. He argued that the Border Patrol's explanation for why he stopped him was just plain racist.
Can they say that a person who appears to be of Mexican descent in the area of Southern California, contiguous with the Republic of Mexico, constitutes some rational basis, reasonable suspicion, that that person is an alien? I would contend, if such ever was the case, that would be rank racism.
He made fun of the government's assumptions that agents can recognize Mexican citizens by their grooming habits.
You can test because they have coarse hands, that they wear coarse clothes, they have their hair cut in a certain way. I've had my hair cut once or twice in Tijuana.
The Deputy Solicitor General, Andrew Fry, argued that a Border Patrol agent's job is to keep people from entering the country without permission, and that if they suspect someone is here illegally, agents should stop them.
Suppose a Border Patrol car is driving along the road, and it sees a car drive by, six persons who appear to be Mexicans, and I think that to ask the officer to ignore that fact would be to ignore the reasonableness requirement of the Fourth Amendment.
The Fourth Amendment protects us from unreasonable search and seizure, but it lets law enforcement agents stop a car if they have a reasonable suspicion that something illegal is going on. Brignone Ponce won the case, but the justices decided that Border Patrol agents may use Mexican appearance when they decide whom to pull over, as long as Mexican appearance isn't the only factor. They wrote,
"The likelihood that any given person of Mexican ancestry is an alien is high enough to make Mexican appearance a relevant factor. But standing alone, it does not justify stopping all Mexican Americans to ask if they are aliens."
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I spent over 40 years down there near San Diego, and you get really good at picking them out. Rarely are you wrong if you've lived around the border for a length of time. So anyhow, well, nothing's going to change until it gets a lot worse. So worse is better. I hope that some of these ISIS people come through the border and raise some hell. That's going to force them to do something about the border.
One will be with us, I predict, for a very long time.
Stanley Fish is a professor at Cardozo Law School and author of There's No Such Thing as Free Speech.
Holocaust denial in our society, under the strong absolutist First Amendment views that Eric referenced, is something that cannot be stigmatized or oppressed. Holocaust denial can be promoted on websites, radio programs, videos, and so forth. But in the academy, Holocaust denial is interdicted. It's not that the question of Holocaust denial never arises in the academy. It's rather that when it does arise, it never arises as a live option for belief. It's not something in the academy which is regarded as an alternative position that one might sincerely have. Rather, Holocaust denial is regarded as one might view flatter denial or Elvis is dead denial. That is, it's the property of kooks and crazies. Therefore, although you can write about it and get a position for writing about it in the history department or get promoted in the history department for writing about it, if you advocate it, you will neither get hired or promoted. So why is there this difference? Again, it's the difference between a structure of inclusion and a structure of exclusion. But, and this goes again to Eric's point, and we didn't talk about anything ahead of Eric's point, that the First Amendment that we now have, which I would call, not in a friendly tone, a libertarian First Amendment. The First Amendment we now have is a recent development, and I would say that it only emerged fully in 1964 with the famous case New York Times versus Sullivan, which is a case dear to the heart of all free speech ideologues, and which I think was one of the worst decisions ever issued by the Supreme Court. Now, before New York Times versus Sullivan, it was possible, and in fact it was done by the Supreme Court, to withdraw constitutional protection from speech, either because of what it did, the effects it had, or because of what it said. There was a contents test and then the effects test. The effects test was called the bad tendency test at the beginning of the 20th century. The idea was that some forms of speech have a bad tendency, they incite illegal activity, don't deserve protection. That was then followed, as many in this room will know, by the Holmes-Brandeis clear and present danger test, which said, well, yeah, the effects may be bad, but we should wait until we see how bad they would be, see when the danger is imminent, and then step in. But still an effects test. The content test was a test which said, look, there are some forms of speech which are trivial and worse, and they don't deserve constitutional protection. I have a quote here, one of my favorite quotes from a 1942 cases. Some utterances are no essential part of any exposition of ideas and are of such slight social value as a step to truth that any benefit derived from them is outweighed by the social interest in order and morality. All that changed in 1964 when the New York Times versus Sullivan court said that all speech must be protected independently of either its content or its effects, and independently of whether it was defamatory or it caused distress of a variety of kinds, because the important thing, said the New York Times versus Sullivan court, was to keep the conversation going in a wide open, robust, and uninhibited way,
we've been encouraged to have a conversation here.
Right, which I sometimes call the John Wayne theory of the First Amendment, and that was the beginning of the end of everything.
So.
And that's why the world ended in 1964.
Actually, it was the beginning of the beginning of everything. Let me remind you. Let me remind you what the world was actually like in 1954 when a magazine you've never heard of, because I hadn't until about yesterday, called One, published in L.A.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. Good for you. This was One. Anyone heard of this magazine? O-N-E. Was the first openly gay intellectual magazine. And it was not publishing sex ads or anything like that. It had articles and it had short stories and it was openly gay. And the United States Post Office shut it down because the content was unacceptable to society. They took it off the stands. They said, you can't mail it. And just for good measure, the specific issue that they banned had as the cover story, quote, you can't say that, an attack on the censorship policies of the U.S. government.
Jonathan Rauch is author of Gay Marriage, Why It Is Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America. He's a contributing editor at the National Journal and The Atlantic.
Well, it's my position that no speech should be interfered with, period. No matter what, I believe in totally open free speech because when you try to block free speech, in the end, you make things worse. And maybe I'm talking against myself because, worse is better. Maybe if the Supreme Court threatens to lock us up for talking about the Holocaust or whatever, that'll further more radicalize the base. And so I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. I think it's better if they come down on us. Put the heel down, baby. Maybe then people will finally figure out you're going to have to do something besides bitch and cry. Did I tell you that 85 people in this world control the lives of 4 billion? That's a true story. What you don't hear much is about the population of Africa has risen 300% in the last couple of decades, and mostly they live in the major cities. So Ebola, that's where it's going to go big time, and I'm afraid it's going to be coming big time here too. And one of the big shots, and I forget who it was, I don't think it was Microsoft, but one of them, has now given $9 billion to help the darkies down in Africa with Ebola. You see, these kind of people, they always make things worse to where this disease will spread. And the more you try to help this pest hole called Africa, the worse it'll get. $9 billion. I wonder why he didn't put that into the mill here in the United States. I think there's a $9 billion would have been a long way, went a long way to help a lot of people out in this country. Now, that's $9 billion to fight Ebola. And there's also a lot of big shots giving millions, supposedly, to fight AIDS. Mother Nature's getting pissed.
Is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is that people all over the world have obeyed the dictates of leaders, and millions have been killed because of this obedience. Our problem is that people are obedient all over the world in the face of poverty and starvation and stupidity and war and cruelty. Our problem is that people are obedient while the jails are full of petty thieves and the grand thieves are running the country. That's our problem.
Well, our absolutely rigid Cold War policy prevents us from aiding Assad. Syria has mutual defense agreements with Iran, and we still haven't gotten Iran back to its reliable Shah-run client state status. And Syria has a warm water Russian naval base on the Mediterranean. It's okay for us to have 1,000 bases around the world, but if the former Soviets have 3 or 4, well, that's a threat to the free world, don't you know? Assad made a serious mistake by violently putting down the demonstrations of starving, drought-ravaged farmers. That's what got the revolution there started now almost 4 years ago in Syria. The U.S. reflexively then began arming the opposition because the Russians were symbolically involved. And as with Afghanistan in the 80s, it didn't matter much who the opposition was and what their ultimate aims were. We are still living in the past, fighting the Cold War, and we will go on living in the past as long as it's profitable for the upper echelons of this country. We're kind of stupid that way.
Start working on the left-wingers, the progressives, some of them. A lot of them you can't talk to, of course, any more than you could a conservative. But they're getting very, very upset. Listen to progressive, Mr. Progressive Man here. Sorry, that's Rogue Progressive.
You know, just to try to understand it, one of the purposes of this program has always been to kind of unload, you know? I've said this before. At the end of the day, we're not going to solve anything. You know, my going to this march, September 21st, along with however many hundreds of thousands of people show up, is going to do not a goddamn thing. I know that. I know that. And I think most of the people who are going to go to this march understand that. It's like a last-ditch effort, show of solidarity. Like, you've got to stop this crap and focus on the problems that are serious. Screw ISIS. To hell with Syria. Goddamn Israel. Go to hell, Afghanistan. To hell with Iran. We've got things to deal with. I probably should not be doing radio right now. I really should not. Because I'm going to slip up one of these nights, and I'm going to say the MF word, or the F word, or the S word, or the CS word, or the, you know, I know it's going to happen. And then the affiliates that we have are going to, oh, and that'll be the end of the show. You'll hit the dump button.
Conservative right is hopeless. In fact, they're in bed with the opposition and don't even know it. You got to work on the lefties, on the sharp young lefties. They're getting close to the edge, a lot of them. Not the general rank and file left any more than the general rank and file right. But our future is bringing these people not across the line, but coming up with a conclusion that we're going to have to fight. And we may have to fight alongside some white people that we don't agree with about a lot of things, except who the enemy is. Some of you know about Gregor Strasser and Otto Strasser, Strasser brothers in Germany. I think I'm going to take this time at the end of the show here to read their bio, for those who wonder and haven't been so totally deluded by Hitlerism. Gregor Strasser, leader of the Social Revolutionary North German wing of the Nazi Party, National Socialist Party, and Hitler's most dangerous rival in the early days of the movement. Gregor Strasser was born on 31 May 1892 at Giesenfeld, Lower Bavaria. He was awarded the Iron Cross first and second classes for his service during World War I as a volunteer in the 1st Bavarian Field Artillery Regiment. An apothecary by profession, Strasser joined the Freikorps, whose aim was to suppress communism in Bavaria, and was active in the Lower Bavarian Storm Battalion. His adjutant was the young Heinrich Himmler, placing it under General Ludendorff's military command. Strasser joined the NSDAP as a stormtrooper and commanded an SA detachment during the 1923 Beer Hall Putsch, which led to a brief spell of imprisonment. His election in the spring of 1924 to the Bavarian legislature freed him from Landsberg prison, and he became co-chairman of the National Socialist Party together with Ludendorff, excluding old fighters like Stryker, Esser, and checking the influence of personal enemies like Goering and Röhm. During Hitler's imprisonment, Strasser's organizational talents enabled the National Socialists for the first time to make headway in northern Germany and to found an organization independent from Munich headquarters. Together with his brother Otto, he founded the weekly newspaper, the Berlin Workers' Paper, and fortnightly National Socialist newsletter, NS Brief, for which he hired the young Joseph Goebbels as an editor, and his own independent party press, the Kampfverlag. As a member of the NSDAP Reichstag group, which he dominated at this time, Strasser utilized his freedom of action and paramilitary immunity to challenge what he regarded as Hitler's abandonment of the socialist ideals of the movement. In 1926, he opposed Hitler's proposals concerning a plebiscite about grants to deposed princes, and the Bamberg Party Congress of the same year, the Strasser brothers argued that National Socialism must devote itself to the destruction of capitalism, to the social justice and nationalization of the economy. Until his death, Gregor Strasser was to insist on the expropriation of the banks and heavy industry, and to oppose Hitler's alliance with the Junker nationalists, with the reactionary army leadership and conservative politicians like Hugenberg, von Papen, and Schacht. Strasser's proletarian anti-capitalist capitalism was, however, primarily a means to an end to the establishment of an organic Volkish community and of a new social order which he called state feudalism, where the industrial estate would be at the top of the heap. His eclectic socialist program, which also advocated an alliance with Bolshevik Russia and the anti-imperialist East against the Western democracies, essentially aimed at precipitating the downfall of the existing social order. Gregor Strasser once defined National Socialism as the opposite of what exists today. Between 1926 and 32, Strasser was Reich's propaganda leader of the NSDAP. And in June 32, Hitler made him another official in the party. The rift between them grew, however, when on 7 December 32, the new chancellor, General von Schleicher, offered Strasser the post of vice chancellor and prime minister of Prussia. Strasser, who did not want to split the party, nonetheless advocated National Socialist toleration of von Schleicher's cabinet, which infuriated Hitler, who had insisted that he refuse the offer. Strasser gave way and angrily resigned all his party posts at the end of 32, a defection which deeply shook Hitler, who feared he was losing his grip on the party. Strasser left politics, living quietly as the director of a chemical combine, and was not offered a post in the new National Socialist government. On 30 June 1934, he was arrested and murdered by Hitler on orders of the Gestapo during the Night of the Long Knives. His death and that of the SA leader Ernst Röhm symbolized the destruction of the National Socialist left wing and the vague hopes of a second revolution in the direction of socialism. Now this one's about Otto, his brother. One of the leaders of the Revolutionary Socialist wing of the National Socialist DAP and the younger brother, Gregor Strasser. Otto was born in Weinsheim on 10 September 1897. After studying law and following a brief period as a social democrat, Otto Strasser joined the National Socialist Party in 1925 and helped build up a radical proletarian wing of the movement in North Germany, together with his older brother and young Goebbels, supporting certain strikes of the social democrat trade unions and demanding the nationalization of industry as well as the big banks. Strasser also favored an alliance with Bolshevik Russia and the revolutionary colored peoples of the East, China, India, and so forth, against the declining West. He stood by the NSDAP original 25-point program, emphasizing its socialist content, which he took seriously. This brought him on a collision course with Hitler, whom he regarded as having betrayed the original ideals of the National Socialist Movement. In 1926, Otto Strasser was made editor of the Berliner newspaper, the National Socialist Letters, also becoming propaganda chief of the North German wing of the party. As head of the militant publishers in Berlin, he controlled an important outlet for disseminating his anti-capitalist ideology, which increasingly embarrassed Hitler in his own efforts to woo and win over the industrialists. In other words, Hitler was becoming a national capitalist. The showdown came on 21st and 22nd of May 1930 in a confrontation between the two National Socialist leaders over the issue of capitalism and socialism. Otto Strasser refused to submit and was expelled from the party on the 4th of July 1930. 6 weeks later, he formed the breakaway Union of Revolutionary National Socialists, known as the Black Front, but it failed to win away National Socialist votes from Hitler. Even though Otto Strasser claimed a membership of 10,000, Strasser and some of his followers went into exile in Prague, where he produced a fortnightly paper, the German Revolution, which attacked Hitler's dictatorship but continued to defend the theory of National Socialism. The Strasser left wing of National Socialism was no less racist and anti-Jewish than its adversaries. In his 14 thesis of the German Revolution, Otto Strasser proclaimed that it was the German duty to develop unique racial individualism and resist the cultural predominance of alien Jewry, which in association with the supranational powers of Freemasonry and political Catholicism was either compelled by its racial makeup or driven by its wanton will to destroy the life of the German soul. Nonetheless, as an articulate opponent of Hitler's, Strasser published a stream of books, pamphlets, and during his exile attacked the political system of the Third Reich and of the Führer's betrayal of National Socialist ideals. These works included this book, I can't pronounce it, but which dealt with the blood purge that had taken the lives of Rome, the SA leaders, and his own brother. Further writings such as something about Hitler here. He wrote a book too. There's a whole bunch of books that he wrote here, and one is Gangsters Around Hitler, 1942. And Flight from Terror, 1943, contained a vision of European Federation as well as his own reckoning with the past and the present. During his exile in Switzerland and Canada, Otto Strasser became an advocate of solidarism, a third path between capitalism and communism, which he gave a national, socialist, Christian, and decentralized Europeanist coloring. Returning to post-war West Germany, Otto Strasser tried and failed to win public support for those ideas in the 50s, after he had recovered his German citizenship. In other respects, he appeared to have learned nothing from the past, still espousing a vicious demagogic anti-Semitism in his journalistic publications. He died in Munich on 27 August 1974. So there you go. I'll tell you what, if I was at that time, I would have gone with the Strasser brothers with no doubt, because by that time, Hitler had totally went around the bend, meeting and making deals with the industrialists and the big bankers, he totally dumped the socialist part of the National Socialist program. So tell all your right-wing friends, that's what Metzger says, and if they don't like it, that's too bad. We're tired of playing right-wing games. So while Hitler was fomenting invading other countries, the Strassers were talking about a federation of the Western Europe and Europe, which is totally opposite to this idea of invading and killing everybody. And of course, his attitude on the Russian situation was totally right. It was totally insane to attack Russia. Well, that's it for today, Freya's Day. We'll probably have something on here tomorrow. In fact, we will. Out of the archives, probably, on Saturn's Day. 14:05, and shut up.